He was, by any stretch of the imagination, a great scientist. He traveled the world collecting seeds in a quest to end the famines that plagued his country, starving to death millions upon millions of his fellow citizens. And yet, sometimes politics trump science, as it did during Mao's Great Leap Forward and Stalin's collectivization. And so today we pause to ask, what happens when politics trumps science?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 606th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Tepic who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the board.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmley Tav.
Hello.
Karen.
Hello.
Welcome aboard, everybody. Russian Nikolai Vavilov was indeed one of history's great scientists. As a botanist, he traveled the world, collecting hundreds of thousands of seeds in a quest to end famines that were killing millions of his countrymen. And it really was millions of his countrymen that were dying. Because of his work, 400 new crops would be developed, the incidence of famine would be reduced significantly, and four-fifths of his country's farmland would be planted to his seeds. And yet, sometimes, politics trumps science. And when it comes to trumping science, few in history were more adept than Joseph Stalin. As a consequence of Stalin's trumping science, the world's greatest seed collector, the man whose work would feed millions, would be starved to death in a Soviet dungeon. Of course, politics could never trump science here, right? We live in the land of the free, so it can't happen here. Nonetheless, today we pause to ask what happened to Nikolai Vavilov. Here to help us explore for an answer, we have Gary Nabhan, who is the author of Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine, and also Renewing America's Food Traditions. Welcome to the Food Chain, Gary.
I'm grateful to be here with you, Michael.
Hey, you're quite a foodie, aren't you? My goodness, you run all over the world chasing these things down.
I had a wonderful opportunity after reading about Vavilov and meeting his students for 30 years of retracing his steps through 11 countries, and it was a thrill.
How did you become fascinated with Vavilov, Gary?
I was interested in the centers of origin of crops and how farmers have done most of the plant breeding that our food depends upon. And when I first saw Vavilov's map of centers of food diversity, I thought, well, this is something that more people need to know about, that most of the food that is on our plate every day comes from just a few places around the world where both wild relatives of crops and crop varieties themselves are extremely rich. And we continue to depend upon that wellspring of diversity.
Well, let's start and go back to another era, the Art Museum and the Food Bank in Leningrad, which was called St. Petersburg at the time, correct?
That's correct.
It is called St. Petersburg now.
Again.
Tell us the story about the Art Museum and the Food Bank.
In 1941, as Nazi troops from Germany and their Finnish allies descended upon St. Petersburg, we had a precarious moment in Russian history. Stalin had just jailed Vavilov and sent him off to prison, and considered this effort to use seed diversity to keep the country from famine a failure. And at the same time, they knew that the Nazis were after the treasures of St. Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, they spent millions of dollars evacuating the great art collection at the Hermitage Museum, but just a few blocks away, the world's greatest collection of seeds, an expression of the seed diversity out in fields in 64 countries around the world, was completely neglected. And as the siege of St. Petersburg deepened and 800,000 people became vulnerable to starvation and related diseases because their immune systems were so impaired, 20 people starved to death protecting those seeds against the Nazis, against vandals who were hungry and wanted to sell off the seeds. And so at the same time, the art museum had hundreds of people mobilized under Stalin's command to take care of the art collection. This living art treasure of seeds was neglected and nearly lost in its entirety.
Let me go back a little bit to something you said that people might not have picked up on. You said that 20 people starved to death protecting a stash of seeds. Why would they starve to death when they have all those seeds there?
Their vision that they shared with Vavilov was that these seeds should be planted out if the country were ever to recover from the war to feed the millions of people that were on the brink of starvation because of the failure of Soviet collectivization. And so rather than thinking, well, we should just go into the grain stores and use that as food, they realized that it was much more valuable to save it as the seed crop for food of the future.
Was Vavilov the first seed collector? I mean, was he the first person to travel around the world collecting the seeds?
There were people like the colonial seed collectors right after the time of Columbus, basically physician scientists who, as part of the colonial endeavor, went to many countries and brought seeds back to the botanical gardens of Spain and Italy and Portugal.
But these were like...
Vavilov was the first one who looked at it from an ecological and evolutionary approach. He was informed by the early work of the Descandolles on the origins of cultivated plants, but he was really the first one to go into the field with sort of a perspective of a geographer and ecologist that was also very sensitive to the traditional knowledge of indigenous and peasant communities.
Well, let's talk then about the centers of origin, the Vavilov centers, as they became known later in history. These few places on Earth from which we get most of our principal economic crops. What significance did Vavilov see in them? Why was he so fascinated with going there?
Well, he saw them as the wellsprings of disease resistance, drought resistance, pest resistance that would protect our crops from famine, whether they were bred into new varieties or whether they were used directly by farmers after their collection in comparable climates. And the interesting thing that I discovered during this book is that those centers of diversity actually match almost perfectly what modern conservation scientists and activists call the global hotspots of biodiversity, that Vavilov was nearly a century before the recognition that these areas are where an extraordinary percentage of the total biodiversity of the planet is harbored.
And why
under
is
the guidance of indigenous farmers.
And Gary, why is diversity so important to Vavilov and to us?
Well, it is our bet hedging strategy in a time of unpredictability. And we're certainly in a time of unpredictability with the global meltdown of highly hierarchical economy and global warming that has been triggered by the overconsumption of fossil fuel. Mm-hmm.
And what will diversity bring to us?
That diversity will bring us a buffer against unpredictable climates and conditions in the field. It will bring us the food security that so many cultures around the world are desperately seeking.
So what you're saying then is diversity equals security.
That, to a very large extent, is true if that diversity is used with the notions of food democracy and food sovereignty embedded in it. Vavilov's actual failure, that we can talk about in a moment, was that he was trying to collect diversity and use it under a totalitarian regime.
Right, so that'll come up later. When we do come back from this break, Gary, I'd like to talk about the famines with which Vavilov grew up into, and talk about the impact those famines made on his world, because those of us who live in this world probably have no idea what a famine is. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about what happens when politics trumps science. We're talking about Alexander, or what's his name? I missed
Nikolai.
It. Yes, Nikolai Vavilov and you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Gary Nabhan.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
So what happened to Nikolai Vavilov, the great Russian seed collector, the geneticist, the botanist, the plant collector, the person who went out into the world and identified the principal centers of crop diversity? What happens when politics trumps science? We're talking with Gary Nabhan, who is the author of, there it is, Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolai Vavilov's quest to end famine. You actually did retrace his steps, didn't you, Gary?
I literally used his photos and journal notes to walk the same path and drive the same roads. He used a mule, though. I couldn't find a mule in 11 countries.
So let's take us back to his youth and the famines that used to plague Russia. There was a statistic that you quoted in your book talking about between 1500 and 1700, there were 150 famines.
That's right.
That's almost one every year.
That's right. It was an extraordinarily common occurrence that either freezing cold or drought would trigger a famine, and then there would be a political scramble, an economic scramble to buy up food and sell it to the highest bidder. So as we're well aware of today, a famine is not just an ecologically caused event. It's also a politically caused event.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a huge number of famines almost every year.
And just when Vavilov was 4 years old, there was a famine that imperiled about 20 million people in Russia. 400,000 Russians died in the region that he grew up in. And it was before him the rest of his life, just like the Great Depression was before many of the baby boomers whose parents were severely impacted by the Dust Bowl and Great Depression.
Whew. And at that time, you said that pests and diseases were destroying almost 50% of a farmer's crop.
That's right. The problem was not just crop yields. Almost all scientific efforts to reduce the frequency of famine have focused on high-yielding crop varieties. The post-harvest storage and transport to the most needy has continued to be a problem, as it was during Vavilov's childhood.
Mm-hmm. And so as Vavilov grew up and became a scientist and became a botanist, a geneticist. He went out into the world and was really looking. It was really a quest to end these famines, correct?
That's right. There was an incredible belief that science could cure all problems if offered the right political context, and that's the irony here. All of his siblings became scientists as well. At first, they all thought they would go into the medical field to try to deal with health issues and famine in that manner. And then Vavilov had a epiphany moment where he realized that perhaps reducing crop losses and increasing the adaptability of what farmers had before them to grow might be a better long-term solution to the world's problems than just becoming one more physician.
Mm-hmm. Where did he get the idea of the value of genetic variation? Where, you know, to get the idea that, to go out into the world and to find these centers of origin? Where did that come from?
Well, it came from two places, really. He was one of the first geneticists who had an underpinning of evolutionary science to guide his mm-hmm. genetics. So he understood that in places where there was great diversity, there was potentially a lot of variation for traits such as disease resistance or pest resistance, because the pests and diseases had co-evolved with those crops and mm-hmm. vice versa millennia.
And then in these centers, you talk about the importance of food democracy. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by food democracy is the capacity for people to define their own food options and where they wish to source their food and what they mm-hmm. wish to grow, rather than having that imposed upon them by political regimes, as Stalin did with the collectivization effort, or economic pressures such as what we're seeing with Monsanto and other companies mm-hmm. In their way they're offering just a few varieties of patents.
Right, but in these centers of diversity, or the centers of origin, as Vavilov called them, what he found was a lot of food democracy, true?
That's right. Because he was particularly interested in the most rugged, remote areas where monoculture had not overrun traditional agriculture, he saw a lot of seed exchanges between farmers, both of improved varieties, some of which they had bred themselves, and of traditional varieties that had been passed down like heirlooms over the centuries. And he saw an incredibly dynamic, knowledgeable network of farmers exchanging seeds as conditions changed.
Give us an example. Take us to Ethiopia and tell us about the grains.
Well, Ethiopia is proud to be one of the areas that Vavilov called the Center for Diversity, and subsequent studies have really validated a lot of Vavilov's preliminary insights there, that people grew sometimes 8 to 15 varieties of wheat or barley or calf or all three in a field that kept the vagaries of drought or freezes or pests or diseases from reducing yield. There was greater yield stability of food, and that people would exchange seeds along the steep elevational gradients of the Great Rift mm-hmm. Valley, from the highland plateaus down to the bottom of the canyons or rift valleys.
So, for example, somebody who lived at 5,000 feet would travel down the mountain range and trade seeds with somebody else that was farming at 5,000 feet?
Right, and then throwing that seed into the mix, they might find out that because that seed from lower down had greater heat tolerance, that the next year or 3 years after that, having that in their mix helped protect them from famine, because that greater heat tolerance responded well in a year of above average heat at the higher elevation.
So what did Vavilov see in these seeds that would benefit Mother Russia?
He was particularly interested in bringing back to each of the niches in Russia. Obviously, we're talking about a country of enormous latitudinal and longitudinal expanse and tremendous gradients. He liked the idea of taking something from a comparable climate and trying it out in the 180-some experiment stations that were scattered across the country to see if it if its climatic adaptations would work in a comparable climate, and often they did.
So that what he saw in these centers of diversity was a tremendous amount of diversity that could be taken and applied to Mother Russia in a way that would provide a great buffer against the great famines that had ravaged the country forever and ever.
That's right, and I should say that reciprocally, he also freely shared seeds with other countries. It was not to just bolster Russia at the expense of other countries.
Okay, good. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Gary Nabhan, author of Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolai Vavilov's quest to end famine and renewing America's food traditions. Today we're talking about what happens when politics trumps science. The science we're talking about is the genetic science of Nikolai Vavilov, who is one of the world's greatest seed collectors and traveled around the world identifying those places that originated most of our principal economic crops. Looking for diversity, and diversity was the key to food security. But what happened when politics took over? 800-624-2665, 831-4798, right back. Hey, we're on the road with Nikolai Vavilov. Vavilov was one of the history's great scientists, a seed geneticist, a plant explorer, a botanist, a person who went out and identified the principal centers of origin of most of our economic crops, and from them extracted diversity and brought them home to Mother Russia. Gosh, you were talking with Gary Nabhan, who is the author of Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolai Vavilov's quest to end famine. You actually did retrace, and you went to some awfully interesting places in the world. One of the more fascinating places you talk about, Gary, are the wild apple orchards of Kazakhstan.
They are incredible places to walk through, and that you're thinking perhaps that you're walking through another foothills forest like the ones in the Sierras of California, but when you look on the ground around you, you realize you're not walking through beech trees or aspens or madrone. You're walking through a forest of apples and pears.
Now, these are not cultivated apples. These are wild apples?
Well, they are in between. For 8,000 years, these forests have been semi-managed, and apples and pears themselves are not planted in rows or anything like that. They come up spontaneously, but under the guidance of the selection of the Kazakh people over thousands of years. And so they're incredibly tasty, large-sized apples and pears and even some apricots. So you really feel that you're in the place where fruit horticulture began when you walked through those forests.
Is it? Is it the place where fruit horticulture began?
It is certainly one of them. The temperate fruits, about 75% of the wild relatives of all temperate fruits occur in the Central Asian belt between China and Persia, and it's just a remarkable feeling to gain the sense of where our food comes from in that manner.
What did Vavilov extract from his travels through the wild apple forests of Kazakhstan?
Well, again, he had already surmised that mountainous areas with a lot of habitat heterogeneity, a variety of landscapes and microclimates might be where crops originated, not, say, down on the fertile floodplains of the Tigris or Euphrates or Yangtze. And he also knows noticed that the linguistic diversity in these areas was rich, and that each culture tended to name and select apples or pears for slightly different traits. So this combination of cultural diversity and habitat variety was something that he clearly noticed in a place like Kazakhstan or Tajikistan.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of harkens back to the food democracy that you were talking about, whereas when people are free to grow what they want to grow, you have the, you develop this incredible diversity of genetics, and thus the interest for the future. Who knows what which one of those genes is going to provide a key to survive a famine, correct?
That's correct.
So when Vavilov collected all these seeds, hundreds of thousands of seeds from hundreds of thousands of sources, brought them home to Mother Russia, what did they do with them all?
They put these out in the 180-some experiment stations around the country and began to evaluate them, mm-hmm. and select them and do some breeding with them, although Vavilov himself was not a plant breeder. And the interesting thing was that it was probably one of the best conservation and utilization strategies that any scientist could come up with. It's essentially what scientists have done all around the world since then to improve the stability of yields and increase the diversity of nutrients available to us. Mm-hmm. But it was a long-term project, a 20-year, 30-year vision. That's where he ran into trouble.
And everybody who's planted a garden knows things don't happen overnight, right?
Except that Stalin wanted things to happen overnight.
Yeah, let's go back a little bit before Stalin, 1917, Russian Revolution. Lenin comes to power, and Lenin kind of likes Vavilov, right?
It's a very interesting time in Russian history because American and European scientists, some Nobel Prize winners, moved to Russia thinking that science would be integral to advancing Lenin's vision of a modern society where the people involved in production were honored and given the resources to move their agenda ahead. And it's very much like American intellectuals flocking to Cuba in the 1950s or mm-hmm. or to Nicaragua to help with the new agendas there.
So Vavilov is looked upon with great favor, and he becomes kind of the head of this entire army of plant breeders.
The largest agricultural research collective system mm-hmm. ever imagined on the face of the planet, and one that absolutely dwarfed the U.S. Department of Agriculture's efforts at the time. The U.S. scientists were incredibly jealous of him, as were scientists in Western Europe.
Because he had the support of the Soviet government. They sent him around the world. He built an army of research plant breeders and had research stations all across the country, a magnificent program. Then Lenin passes away and Stalin comes to power, and we run into another famine, 1932-34, 5 million people die. But it wasn't just because of famine, because of the food, because of poor growing conditions. What else was going on?
Well, drought was one of the initial triggers for this, but comparable to the complexity and the economic collapse we're seeing now, there were a number of policy changes that really made the Soviet Republic incredibly vulnerable. And one of those was the rapid collectivization of all arable lands in the Soviet Republics by Stalin's commissariats. And the irony was that when you take away private land holdings from small shareholders and say, now your mission is to grow food for the people in the cities, sometimes even depriving the people who are growing the food from the supplies that were being sent off to Moscow and St. Petersburg. There was resistance and negative reaction by the farmers. Their own level of involvement in the agricultural system plummeted, and yields went down, and combined with the droughts that hit Russia at the time, they had a perfect storm.
So it was just exactly the opposite of food democracy that you've been talking about. It became kind of food theocracy of sorts. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about what happens when politics trumps science. Science is represented by Nikolai Vavilov, one of the world's great seed collectors, and what happened when he was trumped by Joseph Stalin. We will be right back with Gary Nabhan, author of Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolai Vavilov's quest to end famine. Right back. 1934, one of the great famines of the Soviet Union. 5 million people died, as largely as a consequence of drought, plus the collectivization of food. And what happened then is a lot of people died, and Joseph Stalin was in need of a fix. What did he do, Gary Nabhan?
He was in need of a scapegoat and a fix. And had heard about a young scientist of sorts who was promoting a barefoot peasant science, T.D. Lysenko, who once said, "Marxism is the only true science." And he could use Lysenko to distance himself from Vavilov, blame Vavilov for the crop failures, call Vavilov science an elite science, and turn the destiny of Russian agriculture over to this young, poorly trained scientist who had some dubious achievements behind him.
Well, now, Lysenko had some interesting ideas. He believed that instead of looking for the genetics to provide a key to surviving famine, you could force crops into doing what you wished. For example, you could take summer wheat and make it winter wheat by freezing it in a freezer or something like that. And so he kind of developed this worldview that was really conducive to the communist way of seeing things too. But Vavilov's people, the scientists, looked at this Lysenkoism and said, these guys are crazy. They're talking about making a camel from a cotton seed. You can't do that. And yet, that viewpoint won out, did it not?
That's right. This was what science historians now call neo-Lamarckianism, that simply through environmental pressures or stresses that you could completely reconform the physiology and phenology or seasonality of a crop.
Wasn't that kind of what Stalin was trying to do by collectivizing all of the land?
Even more interesting was the parallel with the overriding philosophy that people can be dramatically changed in terms of their behavior by placing them in the appropriate setting, by removing them from the capitalistic urges.
So
this was philosophically in line with the overhaul that Stalin was trying to do of Russian society.
So Lysenko gave him the perfect intellectual continuity for doing this. And so there was a contest then between Vavilov, or the pure scientist, and Lysenko, the kind of the politics. And who won?
Lysenko won. Stalin immediately sided with Lysenko, and by 1934, as the famine became apparent in its impact on debilitating the Russian food economy, Lysenko was put in charge of one component after another of the agricultural research program of the Soviet republics.
So he was given the reins, and Vavilov was pushed to the side. But not only was he pushed to the side, but he was eventually pushed into prison.
We think about that time, the precursor of the KGB began to dig up dirt on Vavilov, and much of that was fueled by stool pigeons that infiltrated Vavilov's administration, and by rumor begun by Lysenko himself.
And so we have this incredible irony wherein, because of this man's, Vavilov's, work, you say that 400 new crops would be developed, the incidence of famine would be greatly reduced, and four-fifths of the Russian farmland would be planted to his seed. And yet here is a man who would do whose work would do so much to feed Russia. He is being starved to death in a prison.
And literally wiped out of any recognition in Russian history for more than 30 years, so that as Lysenko took over, first reports, even press releases disseminated to the United States and Britain said Vavilov is correcting the former arrogance and elitist tendencies of his own side, science, and has joined forces with Lysenko. This was, they'd show pictures of them together at a time when Vavilov was already imprisoned and unable to speak to his wife, let alone to Lysenko.
And thus the person who probably did more to feed modern Russia than anybody else dies of starvation in a Soviet prison. When we get back, I would like to ask you, Gary Nabhan, about what happened to the food democracy that was so important to the food diversity around the world, and whether you see any of those trends that Vavilov faced in the collectivization of his world happening to us here in the modern world. Folks, this is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. We have a few minutes left with Gary Nabhan, who is the author of Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolai Vavilov's quest to end famine. And we're wondering what the future holds for us, and in light of what happened to Vavilov. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, what happens when politics trumps science? That's the subject of today's show, and we're talking with Gary Nabhan, who is the author of Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolai Vavilov's quest to end famine. Well, Nikolai Vavilov did pretty good job of ending famine in the Soviet Union, but he paid for it with his life. In fact, he was starved to death in a Soviet dungeon because he was not politically correct. He was politically incorrect. And his opposite, Trofim Lysenko, who said that Marxism is the only true science, won out, and thus Vavilov died in a dungeon. And looking at today's world, I'm wondering if Lysenko did not indeed win out, Gary Nabhan, because I don't see much food democracy in the sense that you spoke of it. And I see, technologies like genetic engineering proving up Lysenko's notion that we can, you know, vernalize crops, or we can indeed make a camel from a cotton seed. What do you think? Oops, maybe I better press the button here so you can have a thought. Go ahead.
On this topic, both at Capitola Book Cafe and at UC Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right that some of the players have shifted. Now it seems that transnational corporations that don't honor the will of the people in any country, that are sort of above the law, are determining the fate of our food system and diminishing our capacity for food democracy more than some of the governments are.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that, as you do, that we have not only a lack of seeds in some kinds of industrial agriculture, but a lack of structural diversity. We have either very large or very small farms. Now, in Arizona, where I live, they're saying that the future of high-value agriculture will be in greenhouses growing cultures of nutrients that are all patented, and that the agriculture of the middle and the agriculture of the small have both vanished from much of the American landscape, and the same thing is happening in many other countries as well. So don't have that heterogeneity of farmers, we don't have a place for that seed diversity to be harbored.
Unless we go back to metropolitan agriculture, where we have a lot of people on small farms growing for cities, then you kind of go back to that democracy that you talk about. With respect to what you said about Stalin and how Stalin saw food production as an industrial model, and Vavilov saw it as kind of a rainforest model, where you have this just tremendous diversity, a Garden of Eden kind of situation. Where do you see it shaking out, Gary Nabhan? Where are we going to end up?
Well, you know, I think you're right that Vavilov's final visions on his last few trips were seeing nature as a model, just like the Wild Farm Alliance in your backyard has promulgated, that we really need agriculture more responsive to the diversity of the natural world rather than one that replaces that diversity. And, you know, I have a sense that that kind of agriculture will win out. Diverse agriculture
in the end, it might work. Gary Nabhan, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. Folks, tune in on MetroFarm.com for more right back next week. Do stay tuned.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.